Good afternoon. My name is Darla, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Carlos Rafael and Sustainable Fisheries teleconference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to Megan Herzog. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, and welcome to our live audience here in Portland, Maine, and to everyone who's joining us remotely. My name is Megan Herzog. I'm a staff attorney at Conservation Law Foundation, and it's my pleasure to moderate today's teleconference on Carlos Rafael and where New England fisheries go from here. So before we dive in, I just wanted to take a brief moment to acknowledge all the communities that are suffering from the recent storms in the Gulf Coast, in the Caribbean, and beyond. Affected communities are in our hearts and our thoughts today. And the storms and those yet to come are a sobering reaffirmation of how important it is to ensure a resilient future for coastal communities and livelihoods. And so that's what we're here to discuss today. So I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts on fisheries in New England. We have Peter Shelley, Senior Counsel at Conservation Law Foundation with decades of experience in fisheries policy. We have Patrick Shepard. He's a Fisheries and Seafood Associate at Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries. He's a groundfish sector manager and also has experience as an observer. And finally, Tove Braun, who's worked in Maine seafood industry for over 20 years, and she has experience as a state fisheries manager and also now at Downey Sabo. So thank you all for joining us. So we're going to begin with just a brief chat amongst us, and then we'll open it up to questions. And as a reminder, you can submit questions via Facebook. We'll be taking those, or also by pressing star one if you're joining us by phone. And we'll take some questions from our live audience here in Portland as well. So let's dive into this case that's making headlines around the region. Carlos Rafael, he pled guilty to 28 crimes, including conspiracy, falsified reporting to the federal government. To my knowledge, this is one of the largest illegal fishing cases in U.S. history. The implications for New England for our fisheries management system are enormous. In a few weeks, a court will be issuing a criminal sentence. We have civil penalties from federal regulators also pending. And there's been a lot of discussion in the press and in the region about the fate of Mr. Rafael's fishing vessels and his permits and sort of where we go after this case. So let's start with you, Peter. What is the ideal outcome for a case like this? How do we move on from this?
Well, I think the most important objective is to restore confidence in the fishery and the people who are honest and still working in the fishery and have been making New England a fishing capital for hundreds of years. And that confidence has been really destroyed, I think, by Mr. Rafael's behavior. And I'm not going to mince words. He's a career criminal. He pled 28 counts in this criminal proceeding. But in his own reported words, he describes himself as a pirate, and that the government's job is to catch him. And he's had 19 violations, his operations, 19 violations before this that go all the way back to 1994. Reportedly, one of his vessels has had a violation after the indictment. So I think with respect to Mr. Rafael, he has no place in U.S. fisheries anymore. All his fishing privileges should be revoked, in our opinion. I think all the assets that were associated with this criminal behavior should be forfeited. The allegations by a number of people that they had innocent interests in Mr. Rafael's boats and therefore the forfeiture should not go forward, we think are just transparently hollow, and hopefully the judge will reject all those. And then we want to see NOAA Fisheries take aggressive action against Mr. Rafael civilly. So that's Mr. Rafael. I think, he is the third big violator in U.S. fishery law, at least in recent history. The first was back in the 1990s with the Spalt brothers, and then they lost their fishing privileges. The next was Arnie Fugelvogue, who was on the West Coast. The Spalt brothers were in New England, unfortunately, and now we have Mr. Rafael. So, you know, an important example has to be set with Mr. Rafael. The second issue is Mr. Raphael is part of a group of fishermen that are called the sector. And under the sector rules, the sector is supposed to be jointly and severally liable for the behavior of any of its members, meaning that the sector in this case should be liable for all of Mr. Raphael's violations, including the overages. Because of his criminal behavior, he caught a lot more fish than he was legally allowed to. The sector is supposed to be paying that back. We see no signs of them doing so. And so the sector system, if it's going to work, has to play by the rules as well. And then I think the third and perhaps the most important element of this is NOAA Fisheries itself. I think it's fair to say that all eyes are on NOAA Fisheries and what it's going to do. You know, is it going to take a position that illegal behavior is intolerable in U.S. waters, or is it going to compromise that objective by settling for something less than what is proper in these cases? So, you know, lots at stake.
Certainly. Patrick, from your experience, maybe you can help us understand, what does this case mean for small boat local fleets like the ones that you manage?
I'm sure there are listeners from many different walks of life, so I'll try to explain this as best as I can. Fishery managers rely on good data in order to manage fisheries, and those data sources come from fishery-dependent sources and also fishery-independent sources. And when one of those, when either of those data sets are flawed in some way, it affects catch limits for the entire region. And flawed, I think, is an understatement in this case. We're talking about over 30 years of data falsification that have affected catch limits probably long into the future. This is a big deal for small-scale fishermen because small-scale fishermen with entry-level permits or not a whole lot of quota on their permits have to lease fish in from another permit holder in order to operate. And so when you have really low catch limits of a certain species, you have a really high lease price. And that's what we see with Gulf of Maine cod. And when you take a species like Gulf of Maine cod and label it as haddock, then you know that data isn't being fed into the stock assessments, and therefore it's not reflecting accurately in catch limits. So this affects small-scale fishermen in a really big way. And I think Peter said it well. I think one of the only ways to begin to rectify this is to restore confidence in the data. And I think the way that we start to do that is through collaborative research. And our organization is involved in collaborative research programs with the groundfish fishery.
What does that mean, collaborative, Patrick?
So working with the industry to gather this data. Mm-hmm. The data that's gathered right now comes from fishing boats, and it comes from federal research platforms. A lot of times it's not fine scale enough to sort of drill down at what stocks are doing locally, and I think collaborative research is one opportunity to start to drill down at fine scale ecology, fine scale stock status, and get us back on track to managing this fishery the way it should be.
I think that's a really important point about what this means for data. And Togue, I'm hoping you can help us understand. I mean, this case is definitely unprecedented in its scale and drama, but it's arguably also symptomatic of broader problems that we're facing with accountability and management of our fisheries. So I'm hoping you can share a little bit more from your experience about that.
Certainly. I am not intimately involved with the ground fishing industry, but as you said, I have worked in a number of other fisheries. And as a former fisheries manager, one of the things that's really important is fishermen's buy-in. It's not as simple as just putting a rule out there and, okay, on paper this makes sense, that'll work. Whether or not the fishermen believe it will work and whether or not the fishermen believe it's being enforced properly has a huge impact on whether or not it's going to work. And so if the fishermen believe that the other folks out there on the water are playing by the rules, they'll play by the rules. And if they don't, they won't. And I saw it when I was in Maine. You know, a lot of folks hold the Maine lobster industry up as an example of a very well-run fishery. Well, one of the reasons it's run so well is that the fishermen believe that it's working. And so there's a very high degree of compliance when it comes to regulations in the lobster fishery. When I started out at the Department of Marine Resources, the scallop fishery did not enjoy that high level of compliance because there was a lot of poaching out there, and even the guys that wanted to play by the rules saw the rules being broken so often. I mean, some of them felt sort of embarrassed if they did play by the rules. Like, why would they? They'd have to be an idiot to do that. So when you have a case of this magnitude that shows that the rules are being flagrantly violated, it makes it very difficult for the guys that want to abide by the regulations to do that. And there's not a lot of faith right now in groundfish regulations, and there are lots of people a lot of fishermen that want to believe that something's going to be done with this, and I just hope that there is. And if it isn't, then, I mean, NOAA Fisheries has a hard job. I'm not saying, you know, why do they do this? It's a tough job, but they're going to make it a lot harder for themselves if they don't make an example of this.
I think it's important, Megan, to let people know how fishing is monitored in these public waters. The ground fishery, for example, on the Pacific coast has 100% monitoring on every fishing operation. So there's a third party who is ensuring or trying to ensure that all the data is getting reported accurately and properly. And there's, you know, it inspires confidence actually among the fleet, although it's, you know, it's an extra cost because they know everyone else is going to be following the same rules. In New England, I think last year, 14% of the boats, the groundfish boats, had a monitor on them from the federal government. And, you know, that's, so our fishery is run on an honor system, essentially. So that just makes the point you're making. Mm-hmm. But it also makes the point, I think, that we need to get to 100% monitoring in New England, just like they have in the Pacific. And one of the things we'd like to see out of any civil penalties or ever any forfeitures that come from Mr. Raphael's behavior would get at least in part redirected toward funding that kind of 100% monitoring so that no one else would be tempted to follow his course of action in the future.
And Patrick, I know you have experience as a fisheries observer. I suspect you might have some thoughts on this question about accountability and monitoring?
Yeah, I think monitoring in the fleet is important, and a lot of different groups are looking toward electronic monitoring as sort of, you know, one of the things that's going to solve some of our problems. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we need more monitoring in this fleet because of the system that we've created to allow some of this illegal activity to happen. Catch shares are known to consolidate fisheries. They're known to they're not a very good way to preserve small scale fishing. In 2010, when we implemented catch shares, the fleet splintered in four different directions, and that was by vessel size class. We had vessels that were over 75 feet. Making more money in the industry than they had before. The vessels from 50 to 75 feet sort of stayed the same and arguably sort of leveled off. And then the two vessel size classes that suffered the most were small-scale fishermen, the vessels that were under 50 feet, under 30 feet. And that's because of a lot of the regulatory costs that we've associated with this fishery, monitoring being one of them. At sea monitoring right now for a full day of fishing is over $600 a day. And yes, electronic monitoring will alleviate some of those costs, but it's not gonna solve the problem that we have of consolidation in the fishery.
Yeah. Can you help our audience, anyone on the panel, help our audience understand about Carlos Raphael and sort of the level of consolidation this problem that we're talking about? I don't think it's apparent.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about 15.5% of the fishery is owned by Carlos. Amendment 18 was supposed to solve a lot of the
fleet consolidation. That's a fishery management amendment?
Yes, it's an amendment to the fishery management plan for New England groundfish. Amendment 18 was nicknamed the fleet diversity amendment, It didn't end up being a fleet diversity amendment. A 20% aggregate cap on ground fishing quota basically means that if I have deep pockets and I have four friends that have deep pockets, me and my four friends could own the entire fishery. And we're talking about a public resource. This is a public resource, and it could very well be owned by five people. And that's the direction that we're headed. We're seeing permits drop out of this fishery left and right. And that's because of some of the regulatory costs that are associated with the fishery now. Fishermen are small scale fishermen in particular are really struggling with some of these costs.
Many fishermen during this amendment, in fact, more than fishermen, many people commented during this so-called fleet diversity amendment that it was going to produce this effect of allowing people to, the big people to get bigger, mm-hmm. and the small people to have to surrender their access to the fishery. In fact, the experts that the council hired indicated the same, and a lot of that advice was ignored. And so, you know, before this catch share program, before the current program, the permits were basically tied to a boat, and you couldn't move the fishing rights off the fishing boat. So, you couldn't consolidate. After the catch shares, you could move all your permits that you controlled onto one or two boats. And so it became very efficient, and in fact, you would have been foolish not to try to do that
right.
to save costs. So, you know, the worst fears, I think, of everyone during that fish diversity amendment have now been realized, and in fact, are now in criminal court as a consequence of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's a good point, and as it pertains to this case, there are at least 13 fishing permits that are that the court is at least going to have to decide whether or not Carlos is going to have to forfeit those. It's National Marine Fisheries Service job to decide what to do with those assets afterwards, and I hope that they go after more than just the 13 permits that were associated with those vessels, because his other permits were in CPH or are still in CPH, and they're.
Can you explain what that
yeah,
is?
Yeah, sorry, I speak this language every day, so it's. Thanks for reminding me. Confirmation of permit history. So it's basically when you stick a permit on the shelf, it's not associated with a vessel, but you can still lease the allocation from that permit to the vessels that are active. There are a lot more permits that feed quota to the boats that are active on the water. And usually what happens when a permit is forfeited, that the quota that's associated with that permit is redistributed to the rest of the fleet. And the permit is retired, but the quota gets divvied up among the rest of the permit holders. And if we do that with these 13 fishing permits or 32 or whatever the number ends up being, we're actually going to cause more consolidation in this fishery. The rich are going to get richer. The folks that are quite arguably following in the footsteps of Carlos are just going to end up with more. And I hope we can find a more creative way to do something with those assets that actually means something to coastal communities. I think permit banks are a good idea. I think the state-run permit banks in Maine and New Hampshire and Massachusetts and Rhode Island, they already have a considerable amount of public oversight. And in my opinion, I think that a decent chunk of that quota should go into state permit banks so that not only existing fishermen in the fishery have the opportunity to use that quota, but new entrants.
So what you're suggesting perhaps would be not that all of it go to permit banks, but because I'm just thinking the other guys that
yeah.
have their permits right now that have been competing and are now still competing with the sector,
sure.
you know, would like to have some of that
yeah.
as well. They've suffered.
Yeah,
so I would hate to see all of it go into a permit bank and the guys that have been on the water that have invested to maintain a viability in a very difficult environment.
Yeah.
You know,
you're absolutely right.
Out of it.
The common pool is another great example of. You know, there are fishermen, so when you have a ground fishing permit, you can either operate in a sector or you can operate in the common pool. And when you're in the common pool, you don't you don't lease quota from anybody else. You're under a daily limit. And for some fishermen, it doesn't make sense to be in the sector. It's too expensive to be in the sector. For the scale of some of these operations, it makes total sense to be in the common pool. Finding an appropriate way to divvy up those access rights is going to be a tall order for National Marine Fisheries Service.
Definitely. So, Togue, I mean, we're speaking about coastal communities and sort of how New England can turn the page in this bad chapter. What, in your perspective, what's sort of the ideal outcome, just big picture, even just really big picture in this case? How do we move on from this really egregious set of crimes?
I'm not even going to touch that one. honestly, there's all I can say is there's so many ways to approach it, and we are so far down the path that we have already gone on, it doesn't make sense to abandon that path. And like I said, groundfish is not my bailiwick, so I would feel unqualified to answer that at a precise way. I would just comment that I think when you're talking about consolidation, it's important to remember also that, you know, the folks in New Bedford are concerned that if those permits don't stay associated with New Bedford, well, that New Bedford will lose a lot of its infrastructure. And I certainly feel sympathy for them, but part of the reason that I feel sympathy or is it empathy is that I've seen what's happened in Maine. You know, those permits wound up in New Bedford at the expense of other farther, ports in Maine. You know, the shrimp fishery was doing real well in the years that, you know, they used to determine allocation. There's so many dominoes that have fallen to get us to where we are right now. It is so complicated, and there is no easy solution.
I think Mr. Raffo bought some of those Maine permits.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
On the open market and took them down to New Bedford.
Exactly. So we've lost them. So, you know, folks are saying, well, you can't allow this to happen because we'll lose so much. And, like, well, a lot of others have already lost, and that's how you got those. So it's just a really complicated situation, and I don't know how – there's no ideal solution. I think that's what I can say. As a former fisheries manager, I can say the one thing I'm certain of is that there is no ideal solution, and whatever you do is going to upset some people. So just – Try to make sure you listen to as many perspectives as possible and upset as few as possible.
I just want to remind folks joining us remotely that we're going to be turning to questions in a few minutes, so get your questions ready, type them in, send them to Facebook, and get ready to hit star one so we can take your questions. But let's chat a little bit more on the panel.
Well, I think one thing I just wanted to put out on the table was, you know, the accuracy of the data that the scientists are using to try to estimate how many fish are out in the water. Has always been really critical, really important. Pat, you mentioned all the reasons why. But now we have climate change changing the ocean. So it's getting warmer. It's getting more acidic. The plankton levels are shifting from what they have historically been. So there are huge ecosystem changes taking place in the ocean. And unless we get accurate data of what's going on there now, not what was going on there 50 years ago, but how are the fish responding or the lobsters responding to these changes, we're not going to be able to manage them properly. We'll be managing based on a fishery that really doesn't exist anymore. It's changed. And that's a double-edged sword because the region might benefit from some of the shifts of fish stocks from the south that are moving up into New England waters. And it certainly with fish that are in trouble, the managers need to know that so they can cut the quotas down and keep those fish viable as long as possible.
Our system is not responsive, though. We do not have we don't have a finely tuned, quick, efficient way of addressing that. How are the folks that in the Gulf of Maine going to get black sea bass permit?
I mean, right.
We're really entrenched in a system that is not adaptable.
Yeah, there's a whole series of things that need to happen. But you have to start off with the data.
Yeah.
If you don't know the black sea bass are out there,
talking
to your local lobsterman who's catching them in his traps, you know.
Or even with data, it's a difficult situation.
Yeah. And given the importance of data, what are sort of the real-world consequences of a person like Carlos Raphael who's been reporting false data to the federal government? What does that mean for sort of our management system going forward?
Going forward, I mean, it's not possible to connect the dots and say because we really don't know how much data Mr. Raphael misreported or for how long he's been doing it. At one point, he wasn't as big an operation as he is now. Now he's a big operation, so his misreporting could certainly at least confuse the models that are the scientists are using. But it's going to be difficult. And, you know, I think all you can do is just start from where we are, get rid of Mr. Raphael out of the fishery, and try to adjust the models and bring them back up and have them try to reflect accurately what's out in the water. I mean, fishermen, for example, have been claiming for some time that there are more codfish out there than the scientists think there are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons is Mr. Raphael's boats have been pitching cod overboard, you know, in huge numbers, or mislabeling them as haddock or something else. So the scientists are not getting that feedback from the fishing operations to compare with what their research is telling them is out there. And that's a really important feedback loop. And it hurts fishermen when it's not accurate.
Back to this trust theme, trust and responsibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I want to give an opportunity for our audience to ask some questions, and let's see where the conversation goes. Is anyone here? Yes, sir.
If I heard you right, Peter, you said that only 14% of the vessels that are fishing in New England have observers, where 100% in the Pacific are required. How did this discrepancy between these different fisheries management regions occur? Why isn't there a unified approach?
And so just to repeat for those listening, the questioner here in Portland asked, what's the reason for the discrepancy between regions? Why do some regions have 100% monitoring, and here in New England our monitoring coverage levels are so low?
Well, I don't think, you know, I wasn't personally involved in the Pacific shift to 100% monitoring. It wasn't, I mean, basically the fishery got closed. And in order to reopen it, that was the deal that was forced on the fishermen. And it was rocky, and it still is rocky in terms of the cost and the other factors associated with it. But that was sort of the history of it. I think there are cultural factors at play here, where the New England fishery is hundreds of years old, and the people, the traditions that the fishermen carry around and take out on their boats are hundreds of years old. And the notion of having a government person sitting there with a clipboard keeping track of what you're doing out there is alien to about 300 years of fishing history. So that's a problem. And then I think the final problem is that the scientists have taken the position that 14% of the boats being monitored is sufficient for them to guesstimate what the rest of the 76% of the rest of the boats are doing. I don't think any fisherman, if you ask them on the dock whether that was true, would say that was accurate. There's something called an observer effect, and it's been documented pretty well that when you have an observer on board, you tend to behave differently as a fisherman than you would if you don't have someone directly observing your catch. And that's just human nature. I mean, that's not criminal behavior or anything. That's just human nature. You know, when you have a state policeman following you down Route 95, you tend to stay pretty close to, I guess it's 70 miles an hour now in Maine, but you tend to stay pretty close to 70, and when they go, you know, you start to put back on the gas. So it's really a human nature problem more than sort of a cultural mentality toward violating the law. But again, it goes back to the trust. If you don't have 100%, I just don't think there's any realistic way that fishermen are going to trust each other.
Did you want to jump in here?
I don't know. I would not necessarily, and like I said, I have to have the caveat that I am not as intimately involved in the groundfish industry as I was at one point, but I'm not certain that you would need 100% monitoring. That is one way to go about it. If the fishermen trust the rules, they will abide by them. And in terms of the West Coast versus the East Coast, it's just a very different culture, as you mentioned. A lot of small owner-operators here, more corporate on the West Coast. It's hard to retroactively say, after you've been doing something for a long time, and a lot of the guys here are barely making a day's pay, and now we're also going to charge you for this. When they originally had monitoring, the government was able to pay for it, and they keep extending that, and it's an expensive proposition. And from what I remember, observers on the East Coast are a lot more expensive than on the West Coast. I don't know if it's insurance reasons, but it's not as simple as, why don't we have them here? There are, again, as with all fisheries issues, it's a complicated situation.
I think whatever style monitoring we're moving to in the future, I think it needs to also take into account scale of the fishery. It makes absolutely no sense to me why a 36-foot boat that lands an average of 1,000 pounds in a trip has the same exact dollar amount in monitoring costs as a 90-foot boat landing 10,000, 15,000 pounds in a trip. That makes absolutely no sense to me. And I think whatever situation we move toward in monitoring needs to be scale appropriate.
Definitely, especially when you think of Maine, when you have, when you're looking years ago at prospective jobs of monitors. And, you know, it's a lot easier if you're a monitor in New Bedford or a dockside monitor, there are thousands of pounds coming in, than if you're in Stonington and some guy might come in, what was it, twice a year or something with a few pounds of fish. It's the same as like with a scallop fishery, where in New Bedford there are tens of thousands of pounds coming in every day. And then the coast of Maine, we have a few with, the very far reaches of the corner of the country. It's a scale issue, and that's definitely, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to fisheries solving these problems.
And it comes back to the trust issue too. I mean, if the fishermen are trusting in the science and they know that the data that's being collected on their boat is actually going to effectively manage the fishery, I think they would be a lot more on board with bringing scientists on their boat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
again, that collaborative research you were talking about starts to build those bridges between the science community and the fishing community.
It's so broken right now. There's so little stakes.
Anything helps.
Okay, let's go to take a question from the call here. So I have a question from Gib Chase.
Yeah, Megan, thanks. Interesting listening to you guys. I think over the last 32 years, the political interference in the administrations of Reagan and Cheney and Bush and even right now have affected commercial fisheries and the budgets of these agencies, including monitoring and enforcement. I don't know how you're going to overcome this. Recovery management strategies, regulations have been pretty much rejected by the fishing industry since I've been involved, since 1963. That's always been an issue. And the data, on the data stuff, that the research labs collect, the accuracy, is about as good as anyone could get at the time doing the groundfish surveys quarterly. You can't be out there every month, unfortunately. The people that were in charge of these population studies have done a hell of a remarkable job over the years. I've attended port captain meetings back in the 60s, early 70s. That was an eye-opener as to how the science and the data was received by the fishing community. After Reagan's injection with a lot of money at the end of his term into the fisheries, you had overfishing, and we've never really recovered from that. And I don't think we can expect today the fish populations to support the number of fishing vessels that it did at one time, especially back in that brief decade. And
you're going to have
consolidation.
A lot to chew on. Yeah, so consolidation.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot, but it affects everything. It affects everything. And that's what you're dealing with today. So, and you know, when you talk about collaborative research, good grief. We were doing that and interacting with the fishing community back in the 60s and 70s. So I'm not, and illegal fishing is going on whether we like to admit it or not. But that's where we are. How to overcome all of this when you have an administration that's against, regulations and trying to open up everything, I'm not sure. It sets up a condition for the codfather if you're playing right into it. And that's all I'm going to say on it. Thank you.
Thank you. So, yeah, panelists, big picture.
I agree with a lot of that. I don't think cat shares are going away anytime soon, at least not in the foreseeable future. But I think there are ways to make it work. I think there are ways to improve it so that it makes businesses sustainable, it makes the fishing sustainable, it makes the stock sustainable. So I think if this whole too big to fail thing, we really need to change that conversation. We need to set aggregate caps that are appropriate for the industry, and we need to have costs appropriate for the scale.
So the idea that Mr. Raphael's operations are too big to fail. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I agree with a lot of the caller's observations as well, but, you know, it's you can't just throw your hands up, because then it's a complete disaster, and everyone gets hurt. So, I mean, I think it's a – there are a lot of really good people in the fishery. There are a lot of good fishing dealers and up the supply chain. There's some world-class fishery scientists in our region. There's some regulators who really care about trying to get it right. I think what we need to do is really make sure that this history that Carlos Raphael is the last chapter in this old history, and that through the collective effort led by NOAA Fisheries, you know, we can start to rebuild and end up in a better place. But as this caller suggests, it's a big, there are a lot of hills that we're trying to push the rock up.
I like that. That's a nice optimistic angle, because we talk about how it's such a terrible quagmire. I should point out, he maybe think of the fact that there is a lot of good stuff going on. Like you said, there are a lot of organizations and institutions that are engaged in collaborative research. And so when I say that there's very little faith in some of the data, there's also lots of faith in other data. And the more people work together and listen to each other, the better the future is going to be. So hopefully this is an opportunity. And I know there are a lot of people at NOAA Fisheries that are upset about this. So it's an opportunity. Yeah.
Well, that's what, okay. And again, that's why I mentioned the sectors. I mean, one of the concepts behind this sector program, which allowed fishermen to organize themselves into groups, was that they would then police themselves more effectively and be able to communicate with each other more effectively, more directly,
mm-hmm.
And know what each other was doing,
right,
than the government ever could, even with perfect data. That's why the fate of Sector 9, which is almost 100% Mr. Raphael's operation, is still fishing today as we're talking.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there doing whatever it's doing, and it hasn't been held accountable for any of the behavior of its principal stockholder and president.
Troubling. Well, let's take a question from Facebook here. So I have a question from Carol. And Carol asks, what is the timeline for resolution and prosecution here, and how can people influence outcomes? Any of our panelists want to take that?
So the sentencing is happening the 23rd?
Right. The sentencing is happening. There's a hearing scheduled before U.S. District Court Young in Boston on the 25th and 26th.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be really interesting, and people certainly can go sit in the room and watch justice unfold. There's been a plea agreement that has been negotiated between Mr. Raphael and the federal government as far as the 28 violations are concerned. The judge can accept that or reject that. A number of people, including a number of fishing organizations, have been, you know, really, I think, very brave in putting in communications to the judge so that he understands what the larger context is around these violations. And then the civil proceed. So the judge will take it all under advisement at that point and make some decision. He can reject the settlement and impose harsher penalties. So there's a lot unknown, and that proceeding is also going to deal with these forfeitures of the 13 boats that are in the criminal indictment. And as I said, various people, including Mr. Raphael's wife, are contesting this forfeiture, saying that they didn't know what he was up to out there in the water, and therefore these boats shouldn't be forfeited. So that's going to be an interesting proceeding. The civil side, that is the non-criminal side of this, happens with NOAA Fisheries, the agency, the federal agency. They've been saying in the press that they want to come up with some sort of a global solution and get this all wrapped up. We're urging them to get it right rather than do it fast. And so I don't know whether that's going to take 2 weeks or a month or 6 months, but it's really important that they get it right. So that there's no timetable as such associated with that at this point in time. At some point they'll say what they're going to do, and I just hope it does move the ball forward.
I don't think it's too late to send in victim statements to the court, and I think that's a good idea.
Can you explain what's in a victim statement? A victim statement is
if you're affected by the criminal activity that's happening, you can claim victim to that crime, and that's what a lot of fishermen and fishery organizations in New England are doing. They're submitting victim statements to the court, claiming victim to the crime. You can actually claim, you can actually speak on behalf of the fish as a victim. It's true. You can speak on behalf of the fish as a victim to the crime. So I think it's a good idea to do that. And I think it's also a good idea to write to John Bullard at the National Marine Fisheries Service and make recommendations that you think would benefit New England and benefit the fishery.
I think one other thing I don't want to leave out is that some members of the New England congressional delegation have been speaking very powerfully to the agency on this issue, and Senator King and Collins in Maine have written a couple of times, really trying to emphasize the importance of this. The Massachusetts delegation, the silence is kind of deafening. As far as I know, no one has said anything about this particular incident. The New England Fishery Management
Council,
who are the managers whose programs Mr. Raphael gutted through his behavior, they made a statement back in March that his behavior was deplorable and, you know, way to go, federal government, and let's go forward. But the council itself has not taken any formal position on this violation that happened on their watch in their front yard and is jeopardizing the kind of management that they're hoping to accomplish. So, you know, it's important that people speak out, particularly some of these thought leaders who have been silent.
And for those joining us, CLF will be posting the regional administrator, John Bullard's, contact information on our Facebook page. So if you're looking for how to get in touch with NOAA Fisheries, you can do so. So let's take another question here. We have, how about anyone here in the room? Yes, please.
I'm wondering whether it wouldn't make sense, this is Ann Hayden, for NOAA Fisheries to consider, when it's deciding the forfeiture issue, to consider the example of a couple of fisheries here in Maine that solve this problem of data and of enforcement. And I'm thinking of our lobster fishery, one of the most well-recognized sustainable fisheries in the world, and the scallop fishery. In terms of the scientists and the fishermen work together, not just in collaborative research, but in collaborative management. And wouldn't NOAA Fisheries be well advised to consider some type of pilot project for small boat fishermen working in the ground fishery in eastern Maine that would use some of these same principles that's worked so well here in Maine?
Yeah. So for those on the phone who may not have heard, Anne here in the room asked why NOAA Fisheries isn't considering Maine scallop and lobster fisheries and the collaborative management and science that they've done as an example for how to move forward here. Do you want to respond to that, Toke?
It would be great if NOAA Fisheries, the interaction that NOAA Fisheries had with its fishermen could be as relatively healthy as the interaction that Maine DMR has with its lobster fishermen. But that was built up piece by piece over decades. I don't think, if there were a way that I could wave a wand and have it, that relationship exist, it would be great. But I don't know how that would happen. And in the scallop fishery, it's better than it was years ago. But it's still not ideal. It's still nowhere near what it is with the lobster fishery. And I really, if I study fisheries management, I see how we may have gotten there, but how you get there, we're so removed from that right now, I don't know how you would get there. And I'm sure they do. I'm sure they're looking at it. If there were some way that they could make this better, I'm sure they'd do it no matter what it was. But there is really no easy path. You're right that involving the fishermen in the decisions is what's going to make any solution more successful, but we supposedly have a system in the New England Fisheries Management Council where the fishermen are involved, and we see how well that works oftentimes. So it's a difficult situation, and I'm just thinking back to, you know, the rules are often put in place by people that have a high share of the resources in order to increase their share of the resources, and that's how things work. And we're very fortunate in Maine that a number of, you know, of coincidences transpired to create what we have in the lobster fishery and a lot of hard work. I don't know how you recreate that retroactively. So it would be great, but I just don't know how you do that. If you have ideas, I'm sure everyone would be happy
hey,
to
Patrick,
hear.
Patrick, do you have any advice? You're hearing some great collaborative science now. Do you have any advice for
Yeah, I mean, in both of the fisheries that Ann mentioned, those management those management ideas came directly from fishermen. In the scallop fishery, at least in Zone 2, there was an idea in Zone 2 of the coast of Maine scallop, the state water scallop fishery, to have a rotational management system in that part of the coast. And my organization, as well as the DMR and some other folks, held meetings up and down the coast and said, listen, this resource is starting to come back. How should it be best managed? You guys are the experts. You're on the water every day. You know, feed us the ideas and let's explore this. And that's contributing to the success of the scallop fishery at the moment. And the same sentiment contributed to the success of the lobster fishery. And I think we can do the same thing for groundfish. I think a lot of these management decisions, I think a lot of these really good ideas are going to come from fishermen, and they have to.
I think notwithstanding what we want, what CLF might want, or any fisherman might want with these proceedings with this Rafael, NOAA Fisheries has limits. I mean, it operates under the law, and the criminal penalty policies are out there. And so, you know, I think many of us are expecting to be disappointed to some degree by NOAA Fisheries, even if it does the maximum that it could possibly do. It's probably not going to go as far as many of us think it should go. And that might suggest some changes in the laws or the regulations mm-hmm. so that this wouldn't happen again. But more importantly, NOAA Fisheries is completely unlimited in terms of the cooperative kind of behavior it has with the fishing communities going forward. Ann Hayden's worked hard on this for much longer than I would have the patience to work on it and has run into a lot of closed doors in the federal government to even do a pilot study, to even try it somewhere. And I think there's some traction happening now. The current regional administrator, John Bullard, is leaving in December, so it's going to be critical who the next regional director for NOAA Fisheries is. Is this someone who believes in experimenting with some new ideas that have worked other places, or is it going to be, you know, more of sort of command and control, which really has characterized a lot of the past administrators, not John necessarily, but, you know, it's been more the NOAA Fisheries culture, so.
Similar theme to the
yeah.
adaptability we
right.
were talking about before.
Yeah.
So I think we have time for one more question from Facebook here. And so Ashin from Facebook asks, what is the general attitude of the community of fishermen? Are they defending Mr. Rafael? Are they distancing themselves? Are they invested in this idea that we're talking about sustainable fisheries? Like, what's happening out there in the water in the ports where you guys are?
This is very tricky. The captains that probably want to speak out, I'm guessing, feel like they can't. They have to operate on the water right now, and they have to operate rail to rail with Carlos's boats that are still out there actively fishing. If I were a fisherman in that situation, I would be I would hesitate to speak up for obvious reasons. But I think it's important that fishery organizations, along with fishermen, come together on this and really voice their opinions on it.
Anything to add there?
No, I mean, I'm not, like I said, that obviously people would like to see this. We don't want to see a repeat of this, and people are certainly paying attention. I certainly have not heard anyone defending what's gone on.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Oh, we have one more question here in the boardroom. Final question.
The short one. This is Sean Mahoney. So what would be the best outcome to come from this sad chapter in fisheries? What would be the best thing that could come out of this whole experience with Carlos?
Sean wants to know, what's the best outcome?
I'm going to say very quickly, vaguely, something that makes people more confident in the management system as opposed to less confident. Mm-hmm. Not specific, but if you can get there, that'd be great.
Let's go to each panelist. What do you think, Patrick?
There were a lot of good ideas that came out of the scoping hearings for Amendment 18. I think if we can use this sentencing as the rationale for putting some of those ideas in, consolidation, driving at these consolidation issues, aggregate caps on quota. We have a huge opportunity right now with the reauthorization of Magnuson to put some of this language in. And if we can use this case as the rationale for putting some of that language in, I think that would start to get there.
I spouted off at the beginning, so I'm not going to repeat all that because. But, you know, I think it is, you know, as I said, there have been three major criminal enterprises in federal fisheries that have been uncovered. Two of them have been New England, the Spalt brothers and Carlos Rafael. I don't want there to be a third chapter in New England on this tale of criminal behavior. And so the best outcome from my perspective, in addition to the agency becoming engaged in moving forward, is that this is handled in a way that will remove any possible incentive anyone left in the fishery would have to repeat the behavior.
Thank you. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, but thank you to our panelists. This was a really thoughtful and interesting conversation. And thanks to our audience, both here and everyone joining us remotely. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Operator, you can conclude our call.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.